Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the court. We have two cases today. Before we begin, I would like to first attend to two matters. First off, I would like to welcome Senior Judge Stuckey back to the bench. We are very appreciative of the fact that he is willing to serve as our fifth judge. Our first case today is United States v. Batters. Ms. Zimmerman, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant?
Yes, Your Honor.
And Major Morgan, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
I am, Your Honor.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you and good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court. May it please the court. The government's appeal in this case was premature. It was filed too early in the process, and the Army Court did not have jurisdiction to hear it. Now, the courts of criminal appeals have a tremendous amount of power, even more than their civilian counterparts. For example, under Article 66, they have this plenary, awesome, de novo review, and carte blanche to do justice when a service member appeals a conviction. But Article 62 contains no such plenary power. Article 62 of the UCMJ very clearly and it limits the appellate court's jurisdiction to hear a government appeal.
Now, from your perspective, what are we to make of two factors here? One is that we've got the mandate in there to engage in liberal construction. But furthermore, it was patterned, Article 62 was patterned after the federal law, and the intent there was to remove barriers to government appeals, except for when there are constitutional implications. What are we to make of that fact in terms of our interpretation of the scope of this particular provision of Article 62?
Chief Judge Olson, with respect to taking them in reverse order, yes, Article 62 should be read. The civilian opinions that interpret the civilian counterpart are persuasive authority, but they're not binding. And there are significant differences between the civilian statute and Article 62. For example, Section 3731 clearly says that the government may appeal dismissals and new trials. Military judges in military courts don't grant new trials, for example. Certainly the liberal construction, it has been added to Article 62, but when you look at the federal civilian cases that talk about liberal construction, they still say that the government has to meet one of the statutory criteria before the liberal construction doctrine kicks in. For example, the Davis case out of the First Circuit talks about how the judge in that case entered an order that fell squarely within one of the bases covered by 3731. And only after that criteria was met did liberal construction analysis kick in. Even before the liberal construction section was added to Article 62, this court has engaged in somewhat of a liberal construction theory. For example, in United States versus Brooks, where the military judge made inquiry of the members and determined that they had voted using an improper procedure purported to find the accused not guilty. Well, this court in 1995, before Article 62 was amended, said that was tantamount to a dismissal, even though he purported to find the accused not guilty. It was really not a ruling based on the sufficiency of the evidence. It was basically a dismissal of the charge. And the reason that case is important, Your Honors, is because in that case, the government was precluded from going further. Right? And that's when Article 62 kicks in, is when the government is finished with all of the recourse it has at the trial court level. That's why we have the appellate remedy, when they are stuck at trial. So the liberal construction mandate does not apply to broaden the appellate court's jurisdiction. It just gives the court some leeway in determining if something is not called a dismissal, for example, if it's called some other order. Then, for example, a perfect example would be orders of abatement. Right? This court has found sometimes abatement orders do terminate the proceedings because the government can't go any further. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes the abatement's more in the nature of a continuance or a conditional order that upon the happening of a certain event, the trial can proceed.
Now, along those lines, in your brief, you draw a distinction between mistrials and dismissals. Your point in your brief is that with mistrials, the charges and specifications are still alive. But with dismissals, I forget exactly how you phrase it, but something along the line of they no longer exist. But what about dismissals without prejudice? What's the distinction that you're drawing between a dismissal without prejudice as compared to a mistrial?
Your Honor, the distinction is that even a dismissal without prejudice still requires the government to start over. They cannot proceed. If you think about a charge and specification like a train on a track, and that train is moving towards the government's pursuit of a conviction, if the military judge dismisses the charge and specification, either with or without prejudice, that train is stopped on the tracks. It cannot go any further. They have to go back and do a new charge sheet. They have to do an Article 32 preliminary hearing. And it's a new case. Even if the dismissal is without prejudice, they still have to do a new charge sheet. That charge and specification cease to exist. They are no longer alive.
So is that the determining factor here, the issue of whether a new charge sheet needs to be done and a new 32, that's what transforms something into a new charge and specification?
I think so, Your Honor, and I think you can make the analogy between a mistrial and a rehearing. Let's suppose the Moore case, for example, where the accused was convicted at court-martial and then the appellate court reversed on a Hills error and was authorized a rehearing. When it went back for rehearing, the convening authority decided to amend the charge sheet. Well, by then the statute of limitations had expired, and so the defense upon at the rehearing said, oh, no, Your Honor, this is a new charge and specification. The language is different than the one that was received by the summary court-martial convening authority timely. This is not timely. And this court found that the convening authority is permitted to amend an existing alive charge and specification, and the original statute of limitations still applied. It was not a new case. It was not a new charge. Contrast that to the court's opinion in Adams recently, where the court, the government could have proceeded on rehearing, for some unexplained reason, decided to dismiss and re-prefer a new charge sheet and have a new 32. This court said, sorry, you're out of luck. The statute of limitations has expired. You could have amended the alive charge and specification, but you chose to terminate the proceedings with regard to that charge and specification. That's the important distinction, Your Honor, because Article 62 needs to be read fully, right? It's not just terminates the proceedings. Putting aside for a moment, what does terminate mean and what do proceedings mean? I understand those are issues. But Article 62 only provides a government appeal if the judge's order, the military judge's order, terminates the charge of proceeding, or the proceedings as to the charge or specification. So if the charge and specification are still alive and there are further proceedings that can be held on it, it's not terminated and there's no government right to appeal. Only when that train is stuck on the tracks and cannot go any further at the trial level can then the appellate court get involved. In a mistrial situation, just like a rehearing, the same charge and specification are alive and that train can keep going down the tracks. It might have to shift over to another track, but it gets to keep going. The government doesn't have to start over.
Now, are you basing this on simply, importantly understood, but simply based on the language in 62, or are you saying that there is some rationale, some basis, some reasoning why the authors would make that distinction?
Both, Your Honor. The answer is I think that this court is bound to interpret the plain language of the statute. I think it's not ambiguous. I think it's very clear that only when the government cannot go any further does the government have the right to appeal. And I think to answer the second point, the reason for that is solid. The reason for that is because where there's a mistrial or a rehearing or a withdrawal, just a regular old withdrawal that the convening authority can do, the government still has recourse. There's still a procedure in place for the government to proceed down that track towards a conviction. They don't need to get the appellate courts involved. The reason why the government should be able to appeal a dismissal is because they're done at the court, at the trial court level at that point, and they can't keep going down the track. They can't keep trying to get a conviction unless an appellate court gets involved and says the dismissal.
But again, how does that fit with a dismissal without prejudice? An appellate court would not need to get involved there.
I agree with you, Your Honor, to some extent, but the statute says what the statute says, and I think that there is a, I mean, the words have meaning, right? And dismissals are serious. They have consequences. They are significant events. And whether it's with or without prejudice, it still stops the government proceeding on that charge and specification. With a dismissal without prejudice, the government can still proceed, but not on that charge and specification. That's the answer, Your Honor. The government's train going forward towards conviction on a specific charge and specification that exists on a specific charge sheet, as long as they can keep going on that, there's no right to appeal.
Counsel?
Yes, sir.
You're basically arguing a plain meaning.
Yes, sir.
Interpretation statute. You just affirmed that with the chief judge.
Yes, sir.
Okay. If statute is unambiguous and has a clearly evident plain meaning, then is the liberal construction language surplusage?
No, Your Honor, because the statute doesn't specify which particular orders of a military judge terminate proceedings.
Well, but you're saying that ipso facto, we know which orders they are because of what statute says.
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree.
What are you saying?
So, for example, to contrast the 3731, the civilian statute, it specifically says dismissals and orders of new trial, whereas Article 62 does not. So I think that the court, as I mentioned in the Brooks case, which was before the liberal construction amendment was added, but the point is, this court has the authority, and the CCAs have the authority to determine whether a particular order meets the criteria for terminating the proceedings as to the charge and specification. So just because this Article 62 doesn't say it's limited to dismissals, any order a military judge order, for example, the abatement orders, right? When they put the train stuck on the track, when the parties have reached an intractable state, they can't agree and the case cannot move forward, then appellate jurisdiction lies for the government. And so I do think that the liberal construction principle has application when the courts are determining whether a particular judge's order actually falls within the statute by terminating the proceedings as to the charge and specification. But if the proceedings are not terminated as that charge and specification, then I think that the government appeal is precluded by the plain language of the statute.
Counsel, I have a question since we're talking about the plain language of the statute. But it seems like your interpretation of Article 62 means you could just take out the words, the proceedings with respect to, and it could just say an order or ruling of the military judge which terminates a charge or specification. That seems to be the reading you want to give it. If that's the case, and maybe you can tell me if I'm misinterpreting your argument, what work does the proceedings with respect to do in this language? You've told us that the language is plain. Under your interpretation, I don't understand what work the phrase the proceedings with respect to is doing in the article.
That's an excellent question, Your Honor. And I guess I hadn't thought about that, but my answer would be proceedings should be defined broadly. It's not just the court-martial to which the charge and specification were originally referred. It's terminating all proceedings, right? So,
right, but that's like the key question to me. How do we know? Do they mean this proceeding, this court-martial, or do they mean all proceedings, right? And I think the language isn't clear between those two options. But in your reading, and the government wants it to read this proceeding,
right.
And they didn't say this proceeding either. And they didn't say all proceedings. They just said the proceedings. So how do we know? What's the best evidence you can give us to know that when they said the proceedings, they meant all proceedings and not this particular proceeding?
Well, first of all, is because the proceedings, you have to read it in total. The proceedings with respect to this charge and specification, that's one reason. So if any proceeding, remember, there are lots of kind of proceedings. A court-martial is a type of proceeding. We have contempt proceedings. We have Article 38 proceedings. We have NJP under Article 15 proceedings. We have appellate proceedings. We have lots of proceedings. So I think that my reading of the statute is consistent with the plain language when you say that the proceedings is defined broadly. Remember, the train is stuck on the track. It can't go forward. So any proceeding, whether it's a rehearing, whether it's a new trial, if the government cannot go forward, there's no proceeding to which the government can present evidence and try to get a conviction, then it's tantamount to a dismissal if it's not actually called a dismissal, and therefore the government can appeal.
Ms. Zimmerman, you've reserved 7 minutes, which is quite a bit of time. I see your time now has expired. We'll turn back to you shortly.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Major Morgan.
Chief Judge Olson, Senior Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Major Dustin Morgan, and I, along with Captain Kerry Marin, represent the United States of America. The Army Court had jurisdiction over the government's appeal of the military judge's post-trial order granting appellant's request for mistrial. This is essentially a question of statutory interpretation, and I agree with appellant. We first look to the text of the statute, and if the statute is unambiguous, the plain language controls. This court's opinion in United States versus Jacobson makes that clear. I also agree that the plain language of this statute is unambiguous, but I want to take a step back and look at the statute in total. Specifically,
so wait a minute. You just said you view it as being unambiguous or ambiguous?
Unambiguous, Your Honor. And I want to take a step back and read Article 62A1A in its entirety, and I quote specifically from that article. In a trial by general or a special court-martial, or in a pretrial proceeding under Section 830A of this title, the United States may appeal the following, specifically at issue here: an order or ruling of the military judge which terminates the proceedings with respect to a charge or specification. That needs to be read in conjunction with each other. The modifier of a trial by special or general court-martial is what defines proceedings.
So if I just may ask you something based on what you just said, if it's unambiguous, are you saying that the liberal construction mandate in the statute doesn't apply because it is clear what the language says? We should, as a court, ignore this issue of liberal construction.
I don't think ignore is the right terminology, Your Honor. I think that if this court agrees with the government's interpretation that that modifier, a trial by general or special court-martial, is what Congress is talking about in Article 62A1A, that's clear. In Article 62E, it just doesn't apply in this case. Article 62E arises if this court were to find it is ambiguous and needs to define what the term terminates the proceedings with respect to a charge or specification means. I think that's where Article 62E comes in, because Congress was clear that it wanted this court and the CCAs to effectuate a broad reading of that article to give the government the most complete and fullest opportunity to appeal an order of a trial judge that terminates the proceedings with respect to a charge or specification. Of course, it modifies the entire Article 62, and that was Congress's intent in adding that in 2017. So if this court does find that phrase, that terminology, is ambiguous, which the government argues that it's not, it must be done under this mandate of Article 62E. I obviously fundamentally disagree with the appellant's characterization of that terminology, terminates the proceedings with respect to a charge or specification. If Congress meant terminate the charge or specification, as Your Honor pointed out, they could have said that. Or they could have said dismiss their charge or specification. The allegory of a train, it may be appropriate. But what appellant is arguing for is not a train that is stopped in the tracks. It's as if the train and the tracks are entirely erased and you have to start over with the journey all over again. That's what a dismissal does. It terminates the actual charge sheet. It terminates the charges and specifications that flow and emanate from that document. It's not what a mistrial does at its core. It just resets it. It resets the trial back to that pre-referral stage. It resets the proceedings back to that referral stage. It terminates the proceedings. A proper reading of that terminology of Article 62A1A starts at that key point. It starts at referral and ends at entry of judgment under the new rules of MJA 2016. That is what 62 means. That is what was meant to be appealed in that specific article of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. And that's completely consistent with this court's precedent in the United States versus Wooderich, which tells you to read Article 62 in conjunction with 18 U.S.C. 3731, which is the federal government's equivalent, which also has this liberal construction, this broad grant to the government to appeal interlocutory orders that terminate a proceeding. And it's consistent with the federal practice. I know appellant cites United States versus Yorn in their brief, and we counter that, saying the liberal construction clause of 3731 was added after that decision in 1971. And there's also federal precedent, specifically United States versus Goldstein from the Second Circuit, a 1973 case that came after that liberal construction clause that was added to 3731, that stands for the exact thing that the government's arguing for here today, that stands for the application of this appellate right after the imposition of a mistrial. And reading proceedings in this way is entirely consistent with the rest of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. Appellant's counsel does a good job of pointing out, both in their brief and here at oral argument today, of other mentions of proceedings in the Uniform Code of Military Justice that don't align perfectly with the government's definition, that don't align perfectly with that referral to entry of judgment stage of the court-martial process. But if you read the way it's used in that way, and read the way it's used throughout the UCMJ in a similar fashion, a reading makes perfect consistent sense if you read the code in its entirety. I cite it in my brief, but I'll mention it here briefly again. Article 28, Article 38, 45, 51, and 54 use the term proceedings in exactly the same manner that Article 62A1A uses them. And those are all important stages of the court-martial. There are stages where the military judge has control over the proceedings, where they have the ability to answer interlocutory questions, to rule on questions of evidence or procedure, and to end it. It's also consistent with the president's imposition of the Uniform Code of Military Justice and the rules for court-martial. RCM 907 does use language that's consistent. It does use the term terminates the proceedings. But so does 915. So does the actual RCM that talks about mistrial. It talks about if manifestly necessary that a military judge may declare a mistrial in the interest of justice because of circumstances arising during the proceedings, something that casts a substantial doubt upon the fairness of those proceedings. Reading everything in conjunction with each other, using that liberal construction mandate, if this court finds that the language is ambiguous, again, I'm not arguing that, leads to that logical conclusion and gives purpose and effect to that addition of 62E added in 2017. It's clear from the statute and it's clear from congressional intent that that was the purpose. It was the purpose to give the government the very appellate right that it exercised when it filed with the Army Court and then is now arguing here today. The Army Court had jurisdiction to hear the military judge's grant of the mistrial in appellant's case. And for this reason, pending any questions, Your Honor, this court should affirm. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Zimmerman.
So just taking them in no particular order, to further answer your question, Chief Judge Olson, about dismissals without prejudice, they are significant. Right, because the statute of limitations could expire between the dismissal without prejudice and the re-referral, and that would have a significant impact on whether the case could proceed at any level, but particularly at the trial level, which is the important distinction.
Couldn't that happen with a mistrial, though?
Sorry?
Couldn't that also happen with a mistrial?
No, Your Honor. If the military judge declares a mistrial, the charge and specifications stay alive, and the statute of limitations as it existed at referral remains in effect. And again, the cases of Moore and Adams make that really painfully clear that when the government makes a mistake and dismisses when they shouldn't have, they might have to bear some consequences. Even though it's a harsh consequence, the court is very clear that Congress wrote the statute. Congress is presumed to say what they mean and mean what they say. And even if it ends up in being a somewhat of a windfall for an accused, that's just the way it goes. We don't even get to congressional intent if the statute is clear. So that's one thing. The second thing, so a mistrial will never be statute of limitations barred. Secondly, dismissal without prejudice restores all rights and liberties to an accused, whereas a mistrial does not because the charges are still pending. And third, not related to that issue, but a separate argument is that an Article 39 AUCMJ session is a proceeding, right? There's a record made of it. It would not make sense if the military judge terminated an Article 39A session, that the government could then appeal that. So a court-martial consists of a series of proceedings. The court-martial itself is not just a proceeding. And I would note that the Dossie Court, which we haven't talked about Dossie and Flores, I believe as in the brief, that they're wrongly decided, but even the Dossie Court specifically says that obviously because a mistrial does not terminate all proceedings on a charge, since retrial may be attempted, if that phrase means the latter, we do not have jurisdiction. And then the court went on to forget about the charge and specification language and just interpreted the terminate the proceedings language. But it's not ambiguous. It tracks the statute. It tracks RCM 907, as counsel for the government points out. And I would point out that the language referring to mistrial, the language to which counsel referred is in the discussion section of RCM 915. It's not in the rule itself, so it's not binding. With regard to the government's argument that the statute could be clear, it could specify dismissal. It could, but it also could say court-martial, and it doesn't. It says proceedings, plural. That's an important statutory provision. That it's not just the proceeding, singular. It's proceedings, plural, and it's not the proceeding. It's a proceeding. So, meaning that proceedings should be interpreted broadly. I would still point out, even after the liberal construction, that government appeals are still disfavored and that the burden is on the government to prove jurisdiction because they're the ones invoking it. And
now, how does that general principle that government appeals are disfavored, how does that mesh with the rule? Aren't we required to follow the plain language of the rule?
Yes, Your Honor. But again, I believe that the liberal construction provision operates to determine whether the government has met a criteria that the statute sets forth, not whether it broadens the jurisdiction to invite appeals from other orders of the military judge. Once the court determines that the military judge's order terminated the proceedings as to the charge or specification, there's jurisdiction. And you might need some wiggle room in determining whether the order met that criteria. It doesn't allow the court to expand jurisdiction by considering other kinds of orders that don't terminate the proceedings as to the charge and specification. And I agree that you should look at how the civilians treat this. There's not a single case. The government hasn't cited one. I couldn't find one. There's literally not one single case in the federal jurisprudence where the government was permitted to appeal from a mistrial. Not one. In every case where the word mistrial appears, there was a dismissal or an exclusion of evidence that otherwise brought the government appeal in line with Section 3731. So you are, by ruling in our favor and ruling that Article 62 does not give jurisdiction to the government appeal in this case, your ruling would be perfectly consistent with the civilian jurisprudence on the same issue. I think my time is almost out.
What is your response to the government's argument that Article 62A1, the whole thing is within the context of a trial by general or special court-martial, right? Once we're into a court-martial, the proceedings, the government argues, are the general or special court-martial. Those are the proceedings that they're referring to. What is your response to that?
Your Honor, my response is that, yes, we're only talking about government appeals of courts-martial, not NJP, not contempt proceedings, not some other administrative proceeding, and that's what the qualifier is, that when the government wants to appeal an order that occurred within the context of a general or special court-martial, then it may, if the order terminates the proceedings with respect to the charge and specification. And I would note that the principles of judicial economy and the well-established military concept of handling things at the lowest possible level, those were consistent with allowing the government to appeal only when they can't go forward at trial. If they have another recourse like a rehearing or a new trial, second trial after a mistrial, it's not judicially economic to allow an appeal. Look at this particular case. We're a year into it. I mean, they could have retried Lieutenant Batters by now. If they had just done what they should have done, which was after the mistrial, the Community Authority was free to send it to another court-martial or take other disposition action that was allowed by the rules. Instead, we've been tied up with this appellate litigation at the ACCA and at this court. So allowing the government an appeal in this particular circumstance is not consistent with other principles that apply to this court's rulings and how we should interpret statutes. I think that's all I have, and it's very unusual for me to sit down early, but I will do so.
Not too early. You had only about 9 seconds left.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and we will reconvene at 10:15.